So for a bit of a definition of work product doctrine, the doctrine protects material prepared or mental impressions developed in anticipation of litigation or for trial or for a party or a party's representatives, including the party's attorneys, consultants, sureties, indemnitors, insurers, employees, agents, or agents, and also a communication made in anticipation of litigation for or for trial between a party and the party's representatives, or among the party's representatives, including the party's attorneys, consultants, sureties, indemnitors, insurers, employees, or agents. So the main takeaway is that, the work product doctrine tries to, or it attempts to protect those thoughts of the attorney. And I have it here, that it protects the thoughts, conclusions, legal theories, and mental impressions of the attorneys, but only protects those documents that, again, are prepared in anticipation of litigation. And that has been construed to mean, created because of anticipated litigation, or documents that are created that would not have been created in substantially a similar form, but for the prospect of litigation. So there's a bit of wiggle room there as well. And the work product doctrine is, it's a bit interesting in that it has a couple of subcategories here. We have non-core or fact work product and core or opinion work product. And non-core or fact work product is, it includes general, things like general factual timelines or, pictures of an important place, things like that. And this non-core work product can be overcome by showing that a party seeking discovery has a substantial need for the materials in preparation of that party's case, and that the party is unable to obtain that information or those documents without undue hardship or by any other means. So essentially, if the opposing party can prove that that document is needed for the presentation of their case and there's no other means to obtain that information, then this work product doctrine can, in fact, this non-core work product can be overcome, and that could compel disclosure of those documents. So core or opinion work product. So this includes things such as the lawyer's mental impressions, the lawyer's conclusions, opinions, legal theories of a party, of a party's attorneys or representative. And this goes to the core of the function of course, of attorneys, right? And this core or opinion work product is generally provided with near absolute protection from discovery. Now, it's not absolute, so it's essentially to ensure that, these attorneys, again, have that free space to think and flesh out their thoughts, which is especially important in the incident response space because any kind of incident is a dynamic type of event, right? Things change, circumstances change, new facts arise. So it's important that attorneys are afforded that space to kind of think things through, change their thoughts, and know that those changes are indeed protected. So to switch gears here, we kind of got a background or a refresher of the attorney-client privilege and the work product doctrine. The next couple of slides will go through some of the items that individuals and companies should know or understand to ensure that these protections are not waived, and on the other hand, how to ensure that these protections indeed last. So the first item I have here is that disclosure of attorney-client privilege communications to parties outside of the organization will generally waive that attorney-client privilege communication unless it's disclosed to a third party retained to help provide legal advice. Disclosure of work product, on the other hand, to parties outside the organization waives the protection only if disclosed to adversaries. So in that sense, there's more protection, or said another way, it's easier to waive the protection for the attorney-client privilege when it's disclosed to someone else, because it's automatic with respect, the waiver is automatic with respect to the attorney-client privilege, but it's not automatic with disclosure of that work product. So the next slides will kind of go through some of the highlights or some of the takeaways to keep in mind following an incident to ensure that these protections are in fact not waived. And the first item I have here is that the organization should retain outside counsel. And this is for a multitude of reasons. And I have here just to breeze through these, senior management should promptly determine whether outside counsel should be retained. And this could factor on a multitude of things, you know, of course, one being the cost, two, the likelihood of litigation, or even the likelihood, or the scope of the incident. You know, the larger the scope, the more advisable it is to retain outside counsel. Organization should engage outside counsel in the beginning to actually lead incident response as well. And this outside counsel should lead and coach the investigation from start to finish. And I have here a quote that supervision by counsel is meaningless without substance. And finally, I have here that reliance on in-house counsel to investigate the incident could jeopardize protection. And that's just generally due to the fact that in-house counsel usually have dual roles or multiple roles within an organization. You know, there's a business role and a legal role. And if those are commingled, then it could inevitably, cause a little bit of fuzziness in gray areas with respect to, you know, whether the investigation is actually for a business purpose or for a legal purpose.